Community Connections, CKMS. Local sounds, thoughts, passions, and success. Celebrate local, your neighbor's got a story to tell. Community Connections, CKMS.
Happy May Day, Waterloo Region. It is May the 1st, 2023, Labor Day in most of the world. So we're going to start off with a classic labor song called Which Side Are You On? By Artists for Action. And in a bit, we'll be talking to Need Moksoulis from the Monarchist League of Canada about the King Charles coronation happening this weekend. This is Artists for Action.
Which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on now? Which side are you on?
They say they fight for freedom. There are no neutrals there.
When you stand with hatred, you do not stand a prayer.
Which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
My father was an airman. He flew in World War II. He would not see democracy defiled by men like you.
Which side are you on now? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Side.
Artists for Action, recorded last year. Which Side Are You On? A classic labor song from the mine strife back in 1930, I think. Got in the studio Neil Moog-Sulis from the Monarchist League of Canada, the Wellington Waterloo chapter. Welcome to Community Connections.
Thank you, Rob.
You are the chair of the Waterloo Wellington chapter?
Correct.
Yeah.
So the Monarchist League has various branches across the country, and I'm the branch chairman for the Waterloo-Wellington branch, which roughly covers Waterloo and can stretch all the way up to Bruce Peninsula as well.
Wow, that's a long stretch.
It is.
Yeah. How do members communicate if they're that far away from each other?
Unlike some of the more geographically compact branches, so say Toronto,
mm-hmm.
Trying to gather people together into one location can be a challenge. So large, yeah. Most of the communication is just over email. I'm only new to the role about maybe a year. Usually the way people mainly just join the main league and submit their membership dues that way. And then in time, the league then sends that information down to the branch chairman and say, all right, we've had a new member in Waterloo. Here's the information.
Okay.
And then we have a chance to reach out to them.
And when you reach out, what is the communication that you give? What does the Monarchist League of Canada do?
So the Monarchist League was founded in 1970. And at the time, it was founded as a way to educate Canadians about Canada's historic connections to the monarchy and to the crown, as well as to, frankly, remind politicians and others in government, whether it's politicians or civil servants, about the role of the crown and the important role to make sure that it wasn't diminished inadvertently to a point where it might be pointed out that, what you're actually doing is going against the crown's connection to Canada, and we need to make sure that is strengthened and maintained. So they've just celebrated their 50th anniversary in 2020, and it's still growing strong with branches across the country, as well as a very active online presence as well.
Okay. You said making sure that the government doesn't forget about the role of the monarchy in Canada. Can you tell me what that is? What would you tell me if I was a new member? What would convince me to join?
Well, we're not actively out to recruit members of Parliament or provincial Parliament, though we have several MPPs and MPs and I think senators who have mm-hmm. been League members in the past and are today. But it's more about education. So particularly if a new Premier or Prime Minister comes into office, we make sure with our advocacy to remind them about the role of the Crown, particularly because politics as a society is made up of a spectrum of individuals across various political lines, and some are diehard monarchists, and of course we will support mm-hmm. everything that's important out there, and others have no time at all for the crown, yeah. and everything in between. And so often the league works to identify, are there, say, commemoration events upcoming that should be marked? If there's going to be a royal visit, they assist the various lieutenant governors and governors general to make sure that there is a strong Canadian presence there.
Okay.
To remind the members of the royal family, as well as the governors general and the lieutenant governor, that Canada is a constitutional monarchy and there is support for the crown within Canada.
Okay. And members of parliament are sworn into office. They swear allegiance to the crown of Canada, the monarch of Canada, and all the heirs and successors.
They are.
So how come they need reminding? This is a prerequisite for office.
Well, I think oftentimes, again, it depends on the person taking the oath. In some cases, an oath is a very deeply held commitment, mm-hmm. and I will, every last word, like a marriage vows, every last word I will follow to the letter to my dying day. In other cases, well, I said that, but do my actions really reflect that? Sometimes yes, sometimes mm. no. So that's largely, and we're also advocacy and education. So we have various publications that describe the role of the Crown in Canada. We make those freely available across the country, and we're in the midst of, I think we've been overwhelmed with requests for this booklet. Primarily it was aimed towards students, because they're the ones coming up and learning how the civics of our community and our country work, and to reminding them this is how everything fits together. There's the, the politics you might see in the, in the newspaper or in the media elsewhere, but for the large part, the crown, I think its strength is not necessarily having to be in front of people all the time and quietly does its business in the background while the politicians put their face in front of the camera, because mm-hmm. you know, the politicians are largely looking towards their next election anyways, and their legacy in whatever short period of time they have in office. The crown endures forever, so it's very much building on that tradition it's had for centuries in Canada.
When you say that the crown has to be present in Canada, that's through the Governor General.
Correct.
And so do you advise or lobby or otherwise communicate with the Governor General?
I know that the League Chairman, Bob Finch, he does have a stronger connection to the Governor General as well as the Lieutenant Governor's office. I don't think it's, you know, the nature of the relationship isn't that when Bob calls, the Governor General answers. It's more often the other way around. So if the Governor General, you know, if a royal tour is being planned and that happens through the office of the Governor General, then the League is informed as well and assists in the ways it's possible. Okay. I know similarly the Governor General is hosting a coronation celebration this Saturday in Ottawa mm-hmm. at Rideau Hall, and our League Chairman and some of our other members have been invited to join, along with other Canadians as well, during that celebration in Ottawa.
Okay, you mentioned the Lieutenant Governor for Ontario as well. Is that a role identical to the Governor General at the provincial level?
It is. It is. The way our parliamentary system is set up is that Parliament comes up with legislation, and until the Lieutenant Governor or the Governor General, as representatives of the Crown, sign off on that legislation, it does not come into law. Yeah. It does not come into effect. And so the Lieutenant Governor, like the Governor General, is there to advise the Premier as the need may arise, mm-hmm. But also to maintain the various other duties of the Lieutenant Governor in Ontario.
In Ontario for the Lieutenant Governor, yeah. So in either case, Governor General or Lieutenant Governor, do they have the option of rejecting legislation that the Crown might disagree with?
They do. Oh. It hasn't happened very often. I think the last time it may have truly happened in Canada, and if there's a constitutional scholar listening, they'll probably call in and say you're wrong, but I believe it was in the 1930s when Mackenzie King, the King-Bing crisis, don't pretend to know all the details of it, but Mackenzie King wanted something to occur, and the Governor General said no, and that caused a whole big frou-frou then. I know more recently, I understand that when Stephen Harper wished to prorogue Parliament, and there was, you know, lots of hue and cry in Ottawa, it was the Governor General's office to whom Stephen Harper went, and where the Governor General's office said, "This is how it works, and this is what you can and cannot do. And if this is the path you can choose to follow. If you don't choose, we'll have to go to the next step." And we never got to that point. And I believe, I may be wrong, I believe it was in British Columbia recently, where there was an election where the party that had been ruling going into the election didn't retain a majority and requested the option to continue ruling in a minority government. And in that case, I believe Lieutenant Governor said, well, no, the way things lie right now, it's the opposition that has the right to rule and not you. I believe that's what happened more recently. So that's mainly where the Governor General on a legislative rule of things.
Okay.
Also, just interesting Ontario example. I know very recently the Ontario Not-for-Profit Act was signed into mm-hmm. law, given royal assent. But that was actually passed by Parliament in 2010, and it was delayed for 12 years. That was largely, in that case, because the nonprofits, when looking at the legislation, said, we can't line up all the things that the law says need to have happened, so could you please hold off on it until we get we get things lined up. And it was all done in good faith, but until Elizabeth Dalziel had signed it, it didn't come into law.
Okay. Interesting that.
Yeah.
I was thinking that it was largely the role of a figurehead. You know, there's no actual legislative power that governors general and lieutenants general held.
Well, the analogy I've heard is very much like a fire extinguisher. You have it in the room. It has its purpose, but you never hope you have to use it.
Right.
But if you didn't have it in the room and a crisis happened, then you could be a larger challenge as well.
Right. And how about the monarch himself? Does he have any direct role in the governance of Canada?
Not directly. So since over the 150 plus years Canada's been in existence, there has been a steady devolvement, I guess is the best word, of powers back towards Canada. And so that started in the Statute of Westminster in 1931, where Canada was, you know, accepted as a dominion, and the other dominions of at that time, the Empire, had equal status to Britain. And then finally, in Canada's case, in 1982, when the Constitution was brought home, and that's then when all the powers returned to Canada. And so previously, final rule, you know, the Supreme Court was not the final arbiter. There was the court in Britain that could do that. And in certain cases, Parliament had the ability to reject legislation as well. But through those two different devolvements, the power is all back in Canada. So now King Charles is the King of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that was legislated in the past, sometime in the last couple of weeks, I do believe, King of Canada. So he is the King of Canada, and he's the King of Canada because Britain has a king who's King Charles.
Right.
And the way things are set up is our king is the same as the British king.
And does that directly relate to being a Commonwealth country, or is that the cart before the horse? Are we a Commonwealth country because we have King Charles as our monarch?
No. So we are a Commonwealth country because we were part of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Empire evolved into the Commonwealth of Nations. And within that Commonwealth of Nations, I believe there are 13 countries that have Charles as their head of state, Canada being one of them.
Okay.
And the balance are independent nations with various different levels of governance in their own governments. But they do recognize within the Commonwealth, they recognize Charles as the head of the Commonwealth.
Okay.
And so I guess you might say equivalent to, you know, the Secretary General of the United Nations, where he over, you know, but I think more as a figurehead role. So the Commonwealth of Nations is free to do what they wish to do amongst themselves and to come to consensus and votes and other things. But Charles is the head of the Commonwealth.
Okay. From what I understand is that in a constitutional monarchy, the king does not actually wield much power either, possibly the same as a governor general to provide the final assent on legislation. An interesting thing that I read, King of the Netherlands, King Willem Alexander, was asked by a young child, I would like to be just like you when I grow up. I want to be the king. And Willem Alexander asked, why do you want to do that? Well, I want to be the boss. And so Willem Alexander said, well, dear, this is a constitutional monarchy, and so you are my boss.
Yes.
And I thought that was an interesting perspective. And we saw that happen with King Charles recently as well, when he wanted to go to an ecological summit in Egypt. Can't remember exactly which summit it was.
And one of the COPs.
Yes.
Yeah, I think in 27, perhaps.
And Liz Truss, the prime minister at the time, said, well, we would prefer that you don't do that. And Charles did not go.
So traditionally, the monarch has been neutral on all matters political. Again, they can advise, and oftentimes the advisement is done, you know, behind closed doors or, you know, subtly. You know, the Queen herself has a weekly audience, the King now, has a, you know, weekly audience with the Prime Minister, and it's, you know, there are no minutes are taken. And my understanding is, in general, the Prime Minister, you know, pours his heart out, hears how the week's gone, and the Queen can advise, the King advises as necessary. But traditionally, publicly, because the queen, the monarch, is intended to be the ruler of everyone, they don't traditionally take sides.
Right.
Now, Charles spent most of his, you know, his entire adult life as the Prince of Wales, and the Prince of Wales, as the heir to the throne, had a little more leeway in being able to advocate for things that they thought were important in their lives. And when you look back at some of the advocacy that Charles had, you know, he was into organic farming before it was a thing. I think if you look at a lot of the other things, you know, environmentalism, you know, in the 70s, he was very much a staunch environmentalist. And the reason he wanted to go to COP is because he was an environmentalist, and had his mother not died, he intended to go there in his role as Prince of Wales to see what he could do to build relationships and encourage action.
Yeah.
But as a monarch, he's not allowed to do that.
So even though it's an environmental thing, I would think that, you know, politicals are only tangential to the environmental issues.
Again, everything is connected, and again, very much in that figurehead role, because the king could easily end up, if you advocate for a particularly strong opinion, and it turns out that's not the general will of everyone else, well, now, you know, he's on the wrong side of the populace, and that's not an ideal for any monarch or leader to be. So he's figuring out his role, as anyone does when you start a new job. You know, he's been the monarch for about 9 months now. And though he's been looking forward, I wouldn't say looking forward to it, you mentioned, well, when I'm king, my mother will have died, and that will be sad in its own right, as anyone is when you lose a parent. Mm-hmm. But adjusting to figuring out what is the role now of the monarch, and probably since the day he turned 18, he was preparing to be the monarch. And now, as well as riding the various winds of change, coming to terms with now what does it mean to be king or monarch in the 21st century.
Yeah, how much leeway would the monarch have to change his role in things?
That, again, I think the monarch rules, at the will of Parliament.
Hmm.
And so any changes to the monarch's role would be up to Parliament, would be is my understanding. In general, in its highest sense. Now, it wouldn't, in Canada's case, constitutionally, you can't just have the Parliament in Ottawa say, this is going to be the new rule moving forward, no arguments. In Canada's case, because we have our 13 different parliaments that also must agree, I believe it's a majority must agree to any kind of change to the King's constitutional power. And I think over the 70 years of the Queen's reign, there were oftentimes suggestions or ways that things could change. But in general, I don't think there were, at least during her 70 years, when you think of all the other major changes that happened in society, both in Britain and around the world, they offered a certain amount of stability of, we are always here, we will always be here. Yes, there were certain changes in how they acted and how they interacted with their population. And definitely in the last 10 or 15 years, they've been a lot more active in connecting to the causes that were important to the people over which they ruled, and also listening and advocating on their behalf. And because, similarly, on one hand, a monarch and their family are not intended to advocate for particular roles in legislation that might go against the will of Parliament. At the same time, though, they do have the ability to lift up those voices which might otherwise not have been as actively heard in the, in the current parliamentary democracy that we have today.
Yeah. I can see in some factions that some members of Parliament would be advocating for the elimination of the monarchy in Canada altogether. And that just can't happen without wide consensus across the country then.
Correct. And I think it's important to realize that Canada, as a parliamentary democracy with a constitutional monarchy, welcomes and accepts all sides of any debate. We have, and I think it's safe to say in the 150 years that Canada's been around, that there have always been voices in Parliament and elsewhere who have questioned what the role of the monarchy is in Canada.
Yeah.
And we've seen the adaptation. So that's, I think, that kind of questioning and advocacy, that's when you saw, again, with the Statute of Westminster and a devolution of powers back to Canada, to say that Canada is a country within its own right, but we still maintain that connection back to Britain and the monarchs that have
likely
been rulers.
Those kinds of changes are a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You wouldn't see that more than every 80, 100 years or so.
Well, I think, with the exception of Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth, whom I think collectively between them were monarchs of Canada for about 110, 120 years if you add them together.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be 130 years. I have to remember that Victoria was Queen of Canada before Canada was a country. So that's why you add those together, you still get lots of the time. But in general, monarchs don't rule that long. But even within those long rules, there are opportunities for change and evolution within the office itself. Now, I think for Canadians and for Canada now, we're looking back at the last time we had a coronation was 1953. And when you consider what society was like then, my goodness, it's dramatically different. And I think it'll be interesting to see how we've already seen some indications that the ceremony itself will be changing on Saturday. All the details have not been released yet.
Yeah.
And we will all see we'll see when everyone else sees on Saturday.
I could talk a little bit more about the coronation, but you've picked out some music to play.
Yes.
Anything in particular that we should be playing at this point in the discussion?
Well,
we have the Watermelon Sorbet, we have Rivers Will Rise, and What I Wouldn't Do.
Why don't you go for What I Wouldn't Do?
What I Wouldn't Do. Okay, this is Serena Ryder, What I Wouldn't Do, picked out by Neil Moog Solis.
If you should fall to pieces, you know I pick
Serena Ryder, What I Wouldn't Do, which Neil Moog-Sulitz picked as a suitable track for today's discussion on the coronation for King Charles III.
Yes, well, I chose it specifically because the song is very much, you know, taking an oath of things I wouldn't do to support you. And that's very much, you know, part of the coronation ceremony are the various oaths that the king will be taking to, you know, with his whole life, dedicate himself to the people of Britain and around the world in his role as the king.
Right. Coronation is on the 6th of May, which is Saturday, I think.
Yep.
What happens during a coronation?
So, and it's during a coronation, the king will arrive at Westminster Abbey, where they've held coronations since at least 1,000 years. And then, while he's at the coronation, they will go through various parts of the ceremony with and being presented with, you know, this orb, a scepter, the crown, anointed with holy oil, and then proclaim the king, and then people have the opportunity to pledge their fealty to the king, and then he will return into the gold state coach, be taken back through London, back to Buckingham Palace, and then have the balcony scene to wave to everybody on the mall.
Okay. This is more of a religious ceremony than a political one.
Correct. Though they are intertwined, and the ceremony is very much tied to, you know, the way things had been done 1,000 years ago, where there was no parliament. But I understand that one of the early parts of the coronation ceremony is essentially, you know, this is our king, does everybody agree? And, you know, everybody within Westminster Abbey will hopefully say yes. where in the times past, particularly if you had dueling monarchs mm-hmm. or various kings or different heirs, there might have been some dispute. But generally speaking, it's as you do at a wedding, you don't expect anyone to stand up and say, yes, this couple right. should not get married, because that makes things very much different.
Right. And if that were to happen, I don't think it would really affect the outcome, would it?
No.
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 Charles was proclaimed the king, I think, within days of Queen Elizabeth passing.
Yes. Well, he became king the moment Elizabeth died. Oh. And then they had a series of rituals to go through, proclaim that Charles was now the king. And again, this ties back to, tied back to times when people didn't have, instant communication halfway around the world. And it might take you a few days to, get across right. the country, the realm and recognize that, the king is dead, long live the king, or the queen is dead, long live the king, whatever right. the case may be.
And then the coronation would take place much later so that people would have a chance to gather themselves and come right. celebrate.
Right.
Yeah. So this is actually pretty quick after the passing of the previous monarch. It's a mere 6 or 8 months.
Yeah.
With Queen Elizabeth, I think it was well over a year before the coronation took place after...
Yeah, so she she ascended to the throne when her father died in February 1952. And then, again, in that time, having to bring all the pieces together and also wanting to make sure it was a nice time for coronation, November weather in Britain is not exactly yeah. great. That's where they then chose June 1953. In the case of her father, King George V had died in January of 1936. And then by the time Edward VII decided he was going to abdicate in, pardon me, Edward VIII, he was going to abdicate in November, December 1936, they had already started planning underway for his coronation. So in that case, George VI decided, we'll just use the same date we chosen for Edward's. So in that case, it was very much a short period of time between okay. King George becoming the king and the actual ceremony itself.
Okay, so... It depends.
It very much it depends. But I think the British traditionally May, June, and July for their ceremonial events rather than earlier for right. weather and other things.
Yeah. Wouldn't want to have the royal sled come out to
no.
carry the king
no.
to the palace. People are very interested in attending. I mean, there's going to be huge throngs in London for sure.
Yes.
But locally here in Canada, what's happening here?
Well, locally, at least in Waterloo region, unfortunately, nothing big has been planned. Just the challenges of timing mm-hmm. and certain populations still coming out of right. COVID pandemic, and the challenges of if you host an event, will anybody come? And it, because their attendance could be whether or not they wanted to come to celebrate the coronation, there could be a host of other personal factors as well. So just right. circumstances, there isn't anything big going on in Waterloo region. But I am aware that in Cambridge, in Kitchener, and in Waterloo, various landmarks will be lit up in green, and green and white have been chosen as the coronation colors to celebrate the king's coronation as a nod towards environmentalism. So keep an eye out right. for that. I know down in London, Ontario, they've arranged that various church bells will be pealing to celebrate the crowning of the king. I understand the Lieutenant Governor will be doing something. I'm unfortunately not aware of what it is specifically, and the Governor right. General will be hosting something as well. And the League itself has encouraged people to have various community celebrations as a means, and open to the community as a means to educate the population about this historic time in history, and as well as to welcome new people into the fold, as it were, because they will have heard very much about the coronation, and there are people, whether they're newcomers to Canada or who've had through the education system, weren't necessarily made aware of all the connection to the crown that Canada has. This is an opportunity to educate all of them. So, yes, right. I regret that nothing is happening locally in Waterloo, and that's just yeah. the way things ended up working.
Does the Monarchist League hold events otherwise, other than coronations?
Well, in the before times, so pre-COVID, whenever there was a royal tour, the Monarchist League would invite people to mm-hmm. come, to observe the royal personage wherever they happened to be. And so they would organize, trips to wherever that location where the people were. Before the king's death, before the queen's death, we also held what we called an accession luncheon. And that was held in generally the first weekend in February. And that was to mark the time when the Queen Elizabeth became queen. Right. That was a means to gather together and to meet fellow like-minded individuals.
Right.
The challenge has also been, in terms of other events, Monarchist League, like the Crown itself, has been figuring out new ways to reach out and connect to people. We want to be as open and as welcoming as possible and right. trying to find you know, an event that might, you know, connect to a wide group of people is always a challenge. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of effort. And at least the challenge within the Waterloo-Wellington branch in the past has also been just the geographic size.
Right.
The large urban centers within the, you know, within our territory are Guelph, Kitchener, Waterloo, and Cambridge. And trying to, you know, trying to figure out if you're going to hold an event, well, which of the three or four communities are you going to put it in? And how many people are you going to encourage to come from the other places? It was always a bit of a challenge.
Right.
So no, there will be no garden parties or picnic in the streets, unfortunately. And also, early May can be a challenging time weather-wise, so if we're going to hold it outside, it can be weather like today. Or it could be stifling hot. You never know.
Right.
So,
I know that in the Netherlands, Prince or King Willem-Alexander again, the birthday celebrations are a big national event for the birthday for the king. But nothing like that seems to happen in Canada.
Well, we've traditionally had Victoria Day.
Wrong monarch, though.
Wrong monarch, I know. But as you know, basically, it's the founding monarch of Canada. And I think that's generally been viewed as an opportunity to celebrate the crown in Canada itself. Okay. You know, the queen, I know, at least in the queen's case, you know, her birthday is in April, and her official birthday celebrations, the Trooping the Colour, was in June, again, because the weather was better there.
Right.
But I'm not aware, at least in Canada, of there ever having been a large celebration for the monarch's birthday. It's just something that didn't really happen.
Yeah.
So
something we should perhaps advocate for.
We could
always use another holiday.
And cake. You know.
Indeed. You said that the demographics of the Monarchist League don't lend themselves to in-person gatherings. And I take it to mean that the Monarchist League membership skews towards the older population.
Well, it's one of those weird things. It's almost like there's a bimodal distribution in interest in the Monarchist League. So on one hand, we've got, you know, a slightly older generation of monarchists, and, you know, these are people who've been around, you know, very long time. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, when the league started up in 1970, you know, a large number of your members, and they included veterans, the ones who were willing to die for king and country.
Yes.
You know, when you've gone over the top and that kind of thing, it kind of sits with you that this is something important,
right,
and an institution that's worth protecting and learning about. And then as that generation aged out, you know, it stretched further down to other age ranges. But then at the lower end, we've also got a very active group of young monarchists. And in many ways, they've been the ones, again, as the next generation of monarchists, and very good at driving our social media,
right,
our very social media connections. So whether it's through Facebook, whether it's through Instagram or Twitter, I'm not sure if they've dipped into TikTok yet, but you know, I'm too old for that kind of thing anyways. but I know they've been very active at raising the profile of the league and of the Crown in Canada through those methods. And in many ways, that's the way people live these days as it is. So I know, you know, around, you know, the death of the Queen, the league was very much overwhelmed with interest from across the country of new memberships and interest in the Crown. So it is, again, bimodal distribution, and with some in the middle as well. Yeah. But you know, yes, if you were to hold a garden party, it's, you know, you'd get one demographic. If you were to hold a different kind of event, you'd hold it, get a different demographic. That,
right,
that kind of thing happens with any kind of group.
Yeah. So you said that the young influx of monarchists has helped you with a social media presence. You've got quite an elaborate website here.
Yes.
Very nice-looking one at any rate.
Yes.
You're on Instagram, so I've posted there and linked to that. So it does seem to be that the word is getting out.
Yes.
Have you seen an influx of new memberships since the ascension of Charles to the throne?
Yes. So, again, I don't, you know, as the branch chairman, every now and then I'll just get an update, here are the new members to your group. I haven't had an update recently. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened, and I think they've just been overwhelmed with everything else. Of course, I should have figured out what were the numbers, but I guess the numbers don't matter as long as they're increasing and going up. I think particularly over the last 3 years, there's been, you know, an interest in, you know, a certain amount of stability in the world we're in, and seeing the way that other places run themselves. And yet Canada itself has been a stable democracy for 150 plus years. And you know, I think, you know, yes, there are always ways we can improve how Canada is run and how the different parts interact with each other. But, you know, as a parliamentary democracy with a constitutional monarchy, I think we've done pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. Have another piece of music?
Sure. How would you go for watermelon sorbet?
Watermelon sorbet from Eve Goldberg. Watermelon sorbet, garden party music.
Garden party music, indeed.
So you had a nice story about how you came across that.
Yes. So I first heard that as the opening theme song for a program Bill Richardson did in on CBC as a summer program in the mid-90s. I think it was called Crosswords. But I never knew what the song was. And then about 10 years ago, Stuart McLean on his CBC radio program just played it and said, here's the title. And then I was lucky enough last year that Eve Goldberg played a concert for me in Waterloo. I hosted a concert with Eve, and that's among the pieces she played. But yes, it very much puts me back to time of, again, garden parties, relaxation, and not very much a care in the world.
Yeah. It certainly sounds like typical CBC music that you would hear on Stuart McLean show and whatnot.
Yeah.
Nice to have it on this show, too.
There we go.
Puts me into the big leagues.
And Canadian music to boot, right?
Yes, absolutely. Always like to have the CanCon on the local artists.
There you go.
I want to talk about some controversy. Monarchist League seems to be at the end of the spectrum that is all pro-monarchy. But there's a set that is against the monarchy as well, the Republicans, little R Republicans.
Yes.
Want to turn Canada into a completely independent state, an independent nation, with no ties to monarchs from any other country at all.
Right.
How does that, how do you counter that sort of action?
Well, I guess the first thing to point out is that, you know, Canada has been an evolving country over the past 155 years. And as I mentioned before, both through the Statute of Westminster and the Constitution coming home in 1982, Canada is very much an independent country in all aspects of the word. We do not defer to Britain in our foreign policy or anything else. Yes, Charles is King of Britain, but Charles is King in Canada. And the way the Constitution is written is the king of, you know, the monarch of Canada is the monarch of Britain. And so Charles has been declared, you know, in Parliament declared him the King of Canada. So he's not the King of Britain, everything else, and Canada. He is the King of Canada. So in many ways, Canada is an independent country. Now, as terms of other vestiges of, you know, feeling, well, we need to be an independent country separate from everything else. And as you said, there's a broad spectrum, and even there's a broad spectrum of, again, between, you know, the Monarchy League being a strong monarchist, you know, maintaining connections to the crown in Canada, and the smaller Republicans of, and everyone in between saying, well, are there ways that we can do things differently? And I think there have been Republican feelings in Canada for those 155 years. Mm-hmm. And in a healthy parliamentary democracy, we've been able to have, no, I say we, the royal we, pardon me, of Canada itself, have those conversations about how should we operate and run our country. And we've generally worked through that. There hasn't been a strong, shall I say, unified Republican movement in Canada. Yes, there are various groups that question the role of the Crown in Canada and what its, you know, what its role is and its importance. But particularly when you ask the question, well, what's the alternative? There's often either the questions are either what's the alternative, and there's a struggle there to find a consensus of what would an alternative be, or similarly, how would removing the crown in Canada improve the other grievances there might be within the way that Canadian society operates? Mm-hmm. And that too, there's not really an answer to that either. And, you know, we're never going to go to a libertarian free for all, everybody rules their own backyard. That's just not the way society works. That's not the way our community works. That's not the way our government works. So there will always be a hierarchy within Canada.
Right. I think one of the common complaints is the expense of having to acknowledge the monarchy, having a governor general, the governor general's residence, Rideau Hall. How do you counter those claims?
Well, the League has been, for many years, studying what is the cost to Canadians. And I believe the most recent numbers were run sometime in the last year was that to individual Canadians, it costs $1.54 to maintain the Governor General, the Lieutenant Governor, and everything else within Canada. And I think that works out to about $60 million, plus or minus.
Okay.
And yes, to ordinary Canadians, $60 million seems like a whole bunch of money. But the reality is, you know, it's a functioning part of our government. The majority of that, if we didn't have a Governor General, we would have an equivalent person in that position.
Possibly a president.
Possibly a president or a governor general, but just not a monarch above them, whatever the title might be. There would still be, with as the way Canada is currently structured, there would still be need for that office, for those functions. And so whether he spent $60 million on the governor general, lieutenant governors, etc., or somebody else, that money would still be spent.
Right.
So that's how we counter the how much it costs argument.
There's a lot of complaints about the cost of the coronation for King Charles as well.
Yes. Well, and my understanding is that, unfortunately, a large proportion of that cost is security. And that's just the nature of the world that we live in today.
Yeah.
And so I have not looked deeply at the budget numbers of how much it costs, but that's, if you looked at a presidential inauguration, you'd probably find a similar price tag. That is something that's, again, a presidential inauguration is also seen as an important way of celebrating a transfer of power and marking a transition from one to the other.
Right.
And so, again, whether it's a funeral, whether it's a coronation, that large cost is going to be there. I know Charles has been mindful of the cost. Not that I speak to him regularly, but I understand he has been doing his bits and pieces to see what can he do to make it a more pared down celebration, not perhaps as elaborate in certain ways or more environmentally conscious, to better reflect the times.
Right. I think more than staunch Republicans in Canada, we have more apathy. The CBC poll that ran a little while ago says, poll suggests most Canadians don't want Charles as king.
Yes. So polls, again, are very much a snapshot in time. And I think that one in particular looked at 2,000 people across Canada. The numbers have gone up. The numbers have gone down. Yes, I think perhaps a large part of Canadians' apathy towards the king has to do with the fact that he was Prince of Wales for such a long time, and so we had a better chance to see how he ran his life, for better or for worse. But I think it was Justin Trudeau who said it best, I think sometime last fall, when at the time the Queen died, and there was questions about, well, is this time to make a break and do something different? When he said, I think Canadians have larger concerns to deal with than how we, dropping the monarchy at the moment. And because I think it comes back to that point of, if not the king, then what? And now, I'm also a firm believer in that avoiding change just because, well, it's too difficult to do, or why bother? That's not a good reason for advocating for the system we have right now. I think it's better to look at, what does that system do for us now? And, yes, perhaps if there are changes to be made, yes, have that conversation about what that might be. And I think the other part to remember as well is that the crown is more than just a figurehead for many people in Canada. And in particular, I'm thinking of the Indigenous nations, mm-hmm. which also live within the borders of Canada. Their first treaties were with the crown in Canada,
right.
before Canada even existed. And even though, yes, and I don't pretend to speak for Indigenous people in this community or elsewhere, but I am aware that there, again, as in regular Canadian society, there's a spectrum of attitudes and opinions about that crown-Indigenous relationship. And in many ways, regardless of who sits in that throne, there is a very real connection between our Indigenous communities and the crown. Yes, some terrible things happened in the name of the crown in the last 150 years, but in many ways, those things that happened was not the original intent of those crown-Indigenous relationships. So if you were to remove that crown, the Indigenous nations would be very rightly be able to say, so we need to have an agreement with somebody, right. and it's not the crown, and it may not be Parliament, and now what are you going to do?
From what I've read recently is that Indigenous people, some anyway, seem to like King Charles for his environmental attitudes, and having recognized that Indigenous peoples play a major role in environmental preservation.
Yes. So. And again, as I said earlier, Charles has been an environmentalist since before it was mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe one of the earliest things he did, he was just barely 20, he went up to the Arctic and went diving underneath the ice cap to see what things were down there. When he came up, he was able to speak eloquently about environmental impact on everything. And I do know as well the various times he has visited Canada. And I believe he's visited Canada, I think, 18 times, if I recall correctly. He's always made, whenever the schedule's allowed, sometimes it was just a short stopover, but he acknowledged and recognized the importance of the Indigenous peoples to what made Canada, Canada.
Right. Can you expect a visit from King Charles in the near future?
I would expect so. I don't know how soon that would be. I know when Queen Elizabeth was crowned in, I think, 1953. I believe it was in 1954, 55, is when she embarked on a year-round tour of what was in the empire.
Right.
So I would not be surprised if sometime in the next couple of years you did see Charles come through on some sort of a tour. What that shape will take and where it will be, I couldn't even guess.
Okay. And when that happens, the monarchist league will spring into action?
We will spring into action. That's right. We have a rapid response team. Out we'll go.
All right. People want to join the Monarchist League of Canada. How can they get a hold of you or someone to become a member? And what does it take to become a member?
So to join the league, it's all centralized through our Monarchist League website, so monarchist.ca. And I believe if you look, they just reorganized the website to mark the coronation, so I don't know exactly where it is. But if you look either at Join Now or I'm New, there's an option there where you submit your information. And then the league will collect your information, collect your membership fee, and then share the information with the relevant branch chairman.
Okay.
So, there we go.
I'll put contact information on our show notes page, radiowaterloo.ca/CCC, and you can get a hold of Neil Moog-Sulis then. Neil, thanks very much for coming in and talking to us today on Community Connections about the Monarchist League and the coronation. I learned a lot today.
Good. Yeah. Glad to help, Bob.
Yeah. You've been listening to CKMS Community Connections on Radio Waterloo. It's sponsored by Radio Waterloo. Executive producer is Jennifer Strong. CKMS Community Connections airs every Monday at 11 a.m. and every Friday at 3 p.m. or every alternate Friday at 3 p.m. Our opening theme music was by Steve Todd, and right now we're listening to Vierne, Carillon de Westminster by Camille Saint-Saëns. I'll be back next time. See you then.